Kentucky, Kentucky, Kentucky. It was an unknown wilderness. It wasn't long before they went into the wide valleys through the Cumberland Gap.
This is Old Kentucky Tales, the only podcast that solemnly swears that only one of its participants has ever made a hobby out of reading someone else's diary. Today's title is From Fog of War to Blog of War. I am your host, Brent Taylor. Right here is Jason Donner. Let us start by quoting Lincoln and just say, don't believe everything you read on the internet. You
ever seen that, Jason? Yeah, that sounds made up. I think I have actually like a meme or something.
With us today is a very special guest, Derek Lindo, who is a teacher, a blogger, a scholar, and a gentleman. In this episode of Old Kentucky Tales, our main event will examine Civil War diaries, blogs, and reenactments. In our bonus material, we'll hear an Andrew Jackson Kentucky campaign song. And along the way, don't forget to support the fake history sponsors who support Old Kentucky Tales. The products are real, only the sponsorship is fake.
We have the goods for the younger folk. Wagons, sleds, bicycles, velocipedes, roller skates, ice skates, 410-gauge shotguns, 22 rifles, and flashlights.
The price is right. J.H. Oldham.
Yes, indeed. Let's see. I'm going to need a big old bow for that shotgun. For the younger folks.
Yeah, I mean, those are the children's items. So that's...
I mean, that's a real thing, though. They just did have them. It was, they learned, they used them.
Yeah. You got hunt with dad and all that kind of stuff.
Now, what's a velocipede? I thought that was like a bicycle, but I guess it's not.
Those things are really cool. They're similar to a bicycle. They're kind of like a...
that thing you kind of just... It's stroll like a, on. No chain, no.
It's a big tricycle looking thing.
Oh, is it that?
Or like a big wheel? It kind of looks like a big wheel.
There's like a million pictures of the people riding along that gigantic wheel.
I think they look awesome. I would like to try one.
Yes, I want to ride one. All you velocipede owners out there, let us know. We will do it.
The Velocipede
Club
of Paducah.
Yeah, that gigantic wheel.
Yeah.
That's like a joke.
Yeah, back then they were kind of a hit. But that's a really cool thing that they had. And now for the moment we've all been waiting for.
The main event.
Round one. We're here with Derek Lindo. He is a blogger, of course, and he's a teacher. And he likes all things Kentucky Civil War, Jason.
That's right. I found him on Instagram. We've been following each other. And so I just reached out and thought, hey, why not? Kentucky Civil War expert. Let's get him on.
Perfect fit. Derek, how did you get started with all this?
Civil War history for me has really been something that I've been interested in since I guess I was in late elementary school, middle school, and it's really just kind of blossomed from there. Especially in high school, I really started doing some own studying. That's when I started reenacting then. My parents let me start in high school. And then in college, decided I wanted to be a history teacher, which I am now, and eighth grade history. And so I get to teach the Civil War, and it's just one of my passions. And I wanted to do a little more than just, you know, teach eighth graders about it. I want other people to be able to just see how interesting Kentucky Civil War history is. So that's why I decided to create the blog. I decided I was going to write a book, and this is kind of the thing that went along with it. And it's that book's one of those things that I've been working on for almost 2 years now, and it's been in the almost done stage for about a year. I just can't quite get myself to send it off yet, but hopefully soon that'll be done.
Oh, you'll get there, and it is Kentucky Civil War Author. .com if you want the long URL, or just for short, just Kentucky Civil War, and you should be able to find it out there. And go ahead, Jason.
Well, let's start at the very beginning. In terms of the Civil War, how would you describe Kentucky's particular role during the Civil War? How was that unique? What do we need to know about that?
You used a good word there for it, unique. You don't really see any other state like Kentucky's situation, except for maybe Missouri. But Kentucky is definitely unique, strongly divided, tries to stay neutral for a few months. That's an interesting period there in 1861, those first few months, that armed neutrality. And eventually that breaks down, and you start having guys, you know, going both ways there. And it's, even though, you know, we've got, you know, major battles like Mill Springs and Perryville in Kentucky, people forget about the war amongst the people, especially in different parts of the state. You know, it could be absolutely brutal. You know, Kentucky got a lot of flack for some of its men, you know, not joining up. But when you start looking at some of the sources and reading the newspapers, you see, you know, these houses are attacked all the time, or someone's getting their stolen all the time just because of their politics. And so you almost, you know, you don't blame them for maybe not wanting to leave their families behind.
Right. But they, still, the emotion was there. Everybody was involved.
Oh, yeah.
And had an opinion on it. You just might be right next to somebody who had a different opinion.
Right. And it was interesting. Someone showed me a letter from the McLean County area in Calhoun. And it talked about, you know, this. He was a Union soldier, and he's writing home, I guess, to one of his family members. It's not really stated, just, you know, just a name at the beginning of the letter. And he's talking about his neighbors and how, you know, they think I want to come kill them. You know, I don't want to do that. You know, it's just, I've got my own opinions. They've got theirs. And, but if they come at me, you know, I'll defend myself, you know. So you see a lot of that language, especially in some of the private letters.
Yeah, and plenty of people did sign up. About 100,000 on the Union side, about 40,000 on the Confederate side. So, I mean, there were plenty of people who did pick side over another.
Yeah. But did it become officially one side or the other? I mean, who kind of decides that for a state? We're going to be neutral or not?
The state legislature and, yeah.
Right, I mean...
Yes.
Even though, who leads the way on that, I guess, is my question. Were they ever officially in the North or the South?
I would say they were officially in the North. You know, officially never seceded. You do have this government that's set up in Bowling Green. I think it actually starts off in Russellville, and then they moved to Bowling Green in 1861 to 62. And but I don't think that's something that you could really consider to be a legitimate government, I guess. That governor gets killed at the Battle of Shiloh. And so after that, you know, there's not really much of a Kentucky Confederate government. They, Kentucky is represented in the Confederate Congress. And, you know, that's one of the stars on their flag does represent Kentucky. But you never have that official secession that you see in the other states. And then you start seeing, you know, the amount of men that go to each side. Definitely more men go to the Union than to the Confederacy. But part of that, I think, might go back to what I was talking about earlier, where you had some people that might not really want to leave their homes behind, especially when Braxton Bragg invades in 1862, in the fall of 1862. He was told by John Hunt Morgan that, you know, thousands will join, you know, the Confederate Army, so bring thousands of muskets, which they do. And the turnout is very disappointing for the Confederate Army. One staff officer, I think, remarks that, you know, all these Kentuckians, all they want to do is be in the cavalry. You know, they don't want to be in the infantry, apparently. It was, when you start looking at it again, one of the things was, I think they just didn't quite feel comfortable in leaving their homes behind when they weren't guaranteed success. You know, it was, Kentucky was firmly in Union control, you know, by 1862, especially after the invasion. So it was, I would have to say that it can be considered a Union state, even though with strong Confederate sympathies at the same time.
Right.
It was very pro-Union, but very anti-abolition. So you see that in a lot of the newspapers. They're for slavery, but they're very pro-Union at the same time. So
it is like a tightrope. They were right down the middle.
Right. They were. Right. And it's, a lot of people like to say, well, this part of the state was this way, and this part of the state was, you know, the other way. That's true in certain areas, but for the most part, you know, it's just mixed. With communities are
right,
split,
like house by house.
Yeah.
Are there any particular battles or events that took place in Kentucky though that just stand out?
Perryville is definitely the biggest battle in the state. That was in the fall of 1862 during that Confederate invasion that failed, and it was a one-day battle. And during that day, it was tactically a Confederate victory. They pushed back the Union Army quite a bit, but when they found out that late that night was that they'd only been fighting a portion of the Union Army. And so if they didn't fall back and retreat, then there's a good chance that they could have been, you know, just annihilated. So even though they won during that day, they decided to pull out that night and pretty much just abandoned the venture in Kentucky altogether after that. And so after that, you know, you never see a major push back for Kentucky. You see a lot of cavalry raids, things like that from, you know, John Hunt Morgan and Forrest comes up into Kentucky. You see a lot of that kind of stuff, but you never do see the, you know, full Confederate army, you know, moving into the state again after that, or even trying to.
Right. Let's talk about the Diary of Samuel Cox. Tell us about that.
All right. Well, Sam was a young man in his early 20s. He was born in Hancock County up on the Ohio River. But before the war started, he had moved to Ohio County, which is an adjacent county to Hancock there, just south of it. And his family was a very split family. He went to the Union Army, and he had a brother that went to the Confederate Army. And I think when you read it at the beginning, he doesn't particularly express any strong Union views. It seems like he's almost going for the adventure. So he joins up in the 17th Kentucky Infantry Regiment, and he spends that first winter of 1861 to 62 at Camp Calhoun, which is in McLean County on the Green River. And that was a disease-infested camp. I think over 150 soldiers that were there died that winter just from sicknesses and disease. In February, he shipped off and is involved in the Battle of Fort Donelson. That is probably, to me, the most interesting portion of his diary. He's counting the artillery blasts while Fort Donelson is being bombarded from the Union Navy. I think it's a few hundred. And then he says, and then some. So I guess he got tired of counting. But I'm surprised it kept going that long. The next day, he wakes up covered in snow, and he says, I had my rest interrupted by those damn bomb blasts. and so evidently, even though his side was doing the firing, he'd rather sleep, I believe. But he also mentions that it's times like these I wish I was back in the home guard instead of, you know, being here on the front lines. But so he gets his first taste of battle at the Battle of Fort Donelson and actually gets separated from his regiment and falls in with another regiment. He gets lost in the woods. He's meant to go carry a message to another company of the 17th Kentucky. Gets lost, and he's talking about how he's running through the brush and the bullets are zipping around him, and he ends up falling with the 25th Kentucky, which was the next regiment just in line there. But so he talks about when they enter the fort after the fort surrenders to the Union Army, meeting some Confederate Kentuckians, and you know, they know some of those guys, and they exchange courtesies. You know, they're polite to each other, and even mail some of the Confederates mail for them, which I thought was kind of interesting. You know, once shooting stops, say we can be civil again here.
There's a lot of that gentleman kind of stuff in the Civil War, in right. between the battles.
There is, and that's something he mentions 2 years later when they're in northern Georgia on the way to Atlanta, the Atlanta campaign, and is around this time of year is in late June, 1864, and he talks about how the pickets have decided to stop shooting at each other unless an advance is actually made from one side or the other. And he says, and I think that should have been made a long time ago, if you ask me. So, which was kind of interesting, you know, that, all right, we don't have to shoot at each other all the time unless an actual real attack is being made. Just because we see each other doesn't mean we got to kill each other. So they could trade and stuff like that. And he talks about trading does go on. And then some higher officers put an end to that real quick. So
only in the Civil War, though, right?
Yeah, there's other stories like that. I wanted to ask you about what you're doing online, too, because I know you have the website. It's a blog on Instagram. It looks like you do a ton of photographs. You find things that you share. And what kind of response do you get from either of those, from people?
I would love to do more on the blog. It's just when I first started out, you know, my goal was I want to do, you know, one post a week. And I was able to do that in the winter months. And then once it started getting warmer and I started having to do a lot more outside.
You had to mow the lawn.
Right. Yeah, that takes some time. And then I've got two boys, and oldest is 4 and my youngest is 8 months. And so when he started getting a little more mobile, that required a lot more attention. So,
oh, yeah.
My writing has definitely slowed down to about a post or two a month now. But I'm trying to make them, you know, just good quality. I don't want to rush any of that kind of stuff. So, you know, I do a bunch of different things on there. I do some diary entries from Sam Cox, different months or different events that he experiences. Also, I write some things about some battlefield visits. I like to Shiloh and Stones River in Tennessee. Also wrote some things about a couple family members I discovered that were at the Battle of Shiloh. Both of them were killed. I didn't know that until recently. So there's, you can find a good mix of things on there. There's a couple things I've written about some small battles in Kentucky that are probably very obscure. You know, you do a Google search for some of these battles and you're not going to find anything. So I thought, you know, this stuff's history, and it did have consequences that, you know, when you really look at it, you really start to realize the consequences that these little actions had. So I thought they were important to share. You know, and then on Instagram, there's a pretty good size Civil War community on there, I would say. Just a bunch of fellow history nerds like me, you know, we like to just share, you know, pictures from the Civil War and history and everything. So I try to keep it Kentucky based. There's some other great accounts on there that, you know, they shared the entire war, but I try to keep mine just, you know, solely Kentucky based. So,
right. And you have some excerpts from the Cox Diary. Is that right?
Right. Right.
So, would you like to share one of those with us?
Yeah, I can do that. I'm going to start off here at, the Battle of Shiloh, and, that's, I think, one of the most interesting parts of his diary. Yeah, Fort Donelson in February 1862 was his first big test, and first time he sees it, and he thinks, I'll never see anything this bad. And then, you know, 2 months later, you know, it was the Battle of Shiloh, and then he remarks, you know, I thought Fort Donelson was bad, you know, it has nothing, you know, compared to this. And one thing I noticed is in his early days, excuse me, in the war, he really goes in a lot of detail, you know, about the different men that were killed. He writes about them. He writes about a lot of the things that he sees, especially, you know, some of the dead. And later in the war, he either quits writing altogether. Like in 1863, he has one entry, and that was just a few days after the Battle of Chickamauga. And he just says, well, I'm still alive. Just kind of surprised. It's just like a 2 or 3 line thing, and that's it. And then in 1864, he picks up again and goes day by day for, you know, the rest of the year there until 17th Kentucky is mustered out of service. He's involved in some pretty heavy battles and just says, we had a fight today. Took some casualties, captured some prisoners, and that's really about it. And
he
so
got desensitized, didn't he?
I think so. I think that's what it is. You know, he's seen a lot by that point, and I think he's tired of writing about that kind of stuff. You know, he's been going on for, you know, by this point in by the Atlanta campaign, you know, he's been in for 2 years. I think he's just tired of writing about that stuff, and just kind of wants to keep a little diary of kind of what he did during the day. He always mentions the weather, it seems like, you know, fine day or hot day or something like that. But he doesn't go in that detail like he used to. But just kind of give you an example. Here at in the Battle of Shiloh, he talks about, let me find this particular part here. So when they first move into the battle, to where the fighting's actually going on, you know, the fighting took place, started, you know, about a mile and a half from where they're camped. This is a surprise attack for the Union Army. And as they're being moved forward, they're being swamped by these men that are just running back to Pittsburgh Landing to the river just to get away. And so they're having to move through these terrified men, you know, that are telling them, you know, you're going to get shot to pieces and everything. And, you know, they keep moving. So one thing he says, though, was, so when they start seeing the Confederates start moving up, he says, we could easily see the fight. They get put in line, and then kind of over to the right, they see some of the fighting going on, but it's too far away for them to really be involved. He said, it being but a few rods away, but not close enough for us to participate. We had to wait but a short time, however, as they appeared in front of us in the field spoken of above. And if you ever visit Shiloh, this is in the Peach Orchard, Bell Cottonfield area, kind of over on the eastern side of the battlefield, very on that same road where Albert Sidney Johnston is killed. So it's kind of over there in that area. And so he says, we had to wait but a short time, however, as they appeared in front of us in the field spoken of above. Our order was not to fire until the command was given, which was obeyed almost to the letter. They had probably gotten halfway across when General Hurlbut gave the command, now, boys, give it to them. Our regiment opened, and great God, I never saw men lie down faster when out skirmishing than they did. It seemed to me that the whole line fell. Every man in 40 yards of the flag was either killed or wounded. The flag bearer, however, walked coolly across the field, waving his color. He excited the admiration of all for bravery and coolness. I suppose he had at least 500 shots fired at him, but Providence seemed to be on his side as no person touched him. At this point, we had one or two of Company A wounded. One ball struck Captain Morton squarely in the breast, but being a spent ball, it did no damage. So Captain Morton is somebody that will be mortally wounded later, someone he was very close to, his company commander. But Morton got struck with a spent ball first, which was, it's a bullet that loses its velocity and doesn't penetrate the body. It just kind of knocks into your body. It's, I guess, it'd be like getting hit with a rubber bullet in a way. You know, it's not going to penetrate the skin, but it'll hurt and it'll bruise you.
Right.
And he gets hit with one of those before he gets his mortal wound later. When the retreat actually commences, you know, he's the one carrying Captain Morton back to the landing to the hospital ship and kind of seeing that, you know, he's not going to make it much longer. But another interesting portion of that is after the battle. And it's when he decides to just kind of walk through the battlefield, kind of where they had been fighting. He says, after the battle closed, I took a stroll over the field. It was horrible. The men were thick, some wounded, and some in the cold arms of death. I could tell from the dead where the battle had raged more fiercely. Federal and Confederate soldiers were lying in the agonies of death. You know, and he wrote that on the night of the April 7th, which was the second day of the battle and the close of the battle. So those bodies were definitely pretty pretty fresh there. So,
wow. I can't imagine being the flag bearer in the middle of all that stuff.
Oh, right. Yeah, right. not a place I would really want to be.
Well, someone's got to do it.
Right.
Well, no, they don't.
Someone's got to.
You can just plant the flag back in the back.
Well.
And go for it.
Yeah, but it's a very rousing moment.
Now, that's true. That's what the guy said, right?
Right. They follow that
coolness
flag.
In battle.
Yes.
Because you're just taking 500
bullets.
Yes, of
course, Brent. The flag is important. It's a motivator.
That's amazing. So, once again, this is Derek Lindo, and that blog is Kentucky Civil War.
Hey, let me ask him one thing about his reenactments, because I know that he does the Civil War reenacting. So tell us a little bit about that, what motivates that, and I don't know, I've seen them before, and I guess it's a real opportunity to get a little sense of what that was like for people.
Yeah, it can be, minus the worst of it, definitely. You don't have to worry about, you know, getting, you know, some of the bad sicknesses or the wounds or the death. We don't have to worry about that part. But you know, we do. It has taught me a lot about just what, you know, the average soldier went through on a day by day basis, not just, you know, the battles. But when I was 13, my parents took me to my first reenactment. That was when I was really starting to read everything I could on the Civil War and really had just a strong interest. And so they took me to one that was not too far away from where we lived. Once I smelt that black powder, you know, it stuck with me. So I joined up and with a local unit here, and when I was 16, really have been just expanding the type of events that I do. And I first started off, it was just purely reenactments. You know, my first one, and there was probably about 20 guys on both sides. You know, it was a little rinky-dink event that definitely not authentic at all. But, you know.
How do you tell the not authentic ones from the authentic ones?
Right. You might get a couple sounds. Well, that's what the gun kind of sounds like. So I guess that's something that someone can learn from it. But it's,
this is a real question. But actually, you know, there's acting in this because you have to play along. So when, like, how does that work exactly with the guys? Do they kind of just determine in that moment, okay, you're going to die this time, or is it, how do you know that when you, like, act it out to shoot or to fight?
Yeah, that's probably the question I get asked the most.
Okay.
Especially when I tell my kids in class, you know, I reenact, and they go, well, how do you know when you die?
That's exactly.
A cool question.
Perfect.
Yeah, it is a very common question.
Yeah.
But really, it depends on the scenario. If we're recreating an actual battle, like let's say we did Gettysburg a few years ago for the 150th anniversary back in 2013, and there's different portions of the battle that we were recreating, and you know, we were told, you know, we were portraying this particular unit, so when we get to this point, this is where they start taking heavy casualties. So we kind of knew it'll be kind of light, and then as it, you know, the event progresses, at this point, you know, we need a bunch of guys to start going down. And if it's starting to look kind of silly, you know, we have officers and, you know, NCOs, they'll tell us, all right, we need guys to start taking hits. starting to look kind of dumb. You know, it's been going on for 30 minutes. There's no one dead yet.
No one wants to just lay there on the ground. Is that it?
Right. Well,
people watching,
a lot of guys,
too.
They drive a few hours, and I guess they don't want to go down that first minute. Right.
Yeah, there's that, too.
So that's the most inauthentic part of every reenactment, because somebody has to die in the opening salvo, right?
Right. And it doesn't happen sometimes. Or I've seen a couple times where one gun gets shot, and you got two or three guys that go down.
Magic bullet theory.
Magic bullet, yeah. And so, you know, it's sometimes you get those silly moments like that where it just looks, you know, ridiculous. Right. Apparently, you know, everyone's aim, I guess they just need a warm-up period of about 30 minutes because we're missing like crazy. And then 30 minutes later, that's when everyone starts to go down. So I guess aim really just improves. But, but you know, there's other events that I also participate in that are more authentic-minded that don't have spectators. It's just, you know, 500 guys out on this place, you know, and doing things the actual way where you have, you know, uniform requirements. You know, so we try to get down to the most basic details of a particular unit that we portray. So if their uniforms are a certain way, we make sure we have that, or their equipment is a certain way, and issued rations and things like that. And, you know, we're expected to prepare rations for 2 days. And because, you know, at some of the other reenactments, they have a funnel cake stand, you know, right by the camp. So not exactly authentic there. There's, you know, some others that are very authentic. You know, we get issued period rations, and we have to know how to prepare them the period way, especially coffee. Now, I got to have my coffee. So if
straight
I want that.
Black, is that it?
I need to know how to get coffee just from the beans, or sometimes, you know, it's issued green, so we got to roast it first and everything. So there's, you know, a lot of things that you have to learn to be able to do just the basic things that they did every single day. Because, you know, if you think about it, especially when you read Sam Cox's diary, he wasn't fighting every day. You know, his everyday routine was, you know, eating, doing guard duty, drilling, things like that. And so when you go to some of these other events, you know, we won't even have a battle. You know, it's just for us, and we'll do the everyday things that they do. We have one coming up in February where we are recreating winter quarters at Fort Donelson in next February. And so we're portraying the 49th Tennessee, and we want our uniforms to be just like theirs. So ordered some new stuff and made some changes to my kit that I have. And you know, we're not going to be fighting a battle. It's just we're building the winter quarters just like they did. We're going to be constructing them and drilling and preparing our food and all that kind of thing that they would have been doing every single day. So there's different aspects of reenacting. There are some things that I feel like give reenacting a bad name. But the silliest things that you see and you're like, oh, God, you know, you just can't help but shake your head.
You know, Derek, though, you make a great point about the everyday life of the soldier. It's not a battle every day.
Right.
It's all the little stuff that leads up to the battle, and then that's sort of like the climax, and then it's back to the mundane stuff about you've got to eat and drink and move on to the next place, and maybe you got hurt and you've got to address that. That's a really tremendous point. And if people do want to see more from Samuel Cox, you have all kinds of that stuff on your blog. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, I've probably got most of it posted. There's some other parts I'm still working on. What I've done right now is I post a portion of it, just as he puts it, and then also kind of mirror what he says with some of the reports from his commanding officer, his colonels, that he had throughout the war. And so just to kind of compare, all right, this is what Colonel McHenry or Colonel Stout said about this particular event, and here's what Samuel Cox says. And so they kind of parallel each other in a way. But what I would like to do eventually is, you know, combine it all together into something. That way, a person that just a casual reader is going to be able to pick up and understand what he's talking about. Because if you're not someone that has studied the Civil War, a lot of it's just not going to make any sense. You know, what does this mean? What's this place? And why does that matter?
You know, you need to get it annotated and all that kind of stuff.
Right. And that's kind of my goal, you know, a future project down the road.
Awesome. When you finish that, let us know, and we'll talk about that as a completed project.
Yeah, that'd be a great idea.
So thank you so much, Derek, for taking this time to talk to us today.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Well, so glad that you all invited me on. It's been a blast talking with you all.
Our sponsor for this part of the program is Dr. Sweat's Root Beer. Nature's purest herbs are combined to make this invigorating beverage. Checkerberry leaves impart their familiar and pleasant taste. Wintergreen adds its snap and flavor. Spikenard affords a mildly stimulating effect. Sassafras root improves and blends the familiar flavors of the other herbs. Birch bark tones down the richer flavors of the other ingredients. Something's got to tone it down. Hop flowers add the mild tonic effect that invigorates. Sarsaparilla acts as a blood purifier, making the beverage beneficial. Juniper and juniper berries serve to stimulate mildly and add to the smoothness of the taste. Ask for it at your soda fountain. Buy it by the case for your home. Dr. Sweats, the original root beer.
Yeah, but I'm not getting past that sweat. I don't care how flowery they got with it. I'm still not going to drink Dr. Sweat.
Because you kind of think you know the origin of the root beer liquid, right? It's sweat.
I just don't want to think about sweat when I am drinking. I got some things to look up. I got to look up checkerberry, spikenards, sarsaparilla. What else? I got some things to look up here, man. This is like something you'd see today. You know, like real...
A health drink or something?
Expensive, particular health drink with all this stuff in it.
Only at GNC.
Right, yeah, very good.
Dr. Sweat's original root beer. Okay, Lexington Brewing Company, right there in Lexington. So you might be able to dig up a bottle of that if
How about
it still
change
exists.
One letter and make it Dr. Sweets? Now I want to drink it.
That's so much better. They needed some marketing, right?
Surely someone said, listen, someone tell him.
No, Dr. Sweat was too much of an egotist, right? Somebody probably said that, and he was like, no, the Sweat family name has a proud heritage.
I'm going to make a cold drink and put my name on it.
And thus you get Dr. Sweat's root beer. All right, we... In our political season, In our political season, we've been kind of ramping up to it throughout, and we've got a very special piece of political memorabilia from Kentucky's past. It is a campaign theme song from the Andrew Jackson days.
He led us down to the Cypress Swamp. The ground was low and mucky. There came John Bull and Marshall Pomp, and here stood old Kentucky. Old Hickory led our little band. None wished it to be greater, for every man was half a horse and half an alligator. Oh, Kentucky, the hunters of Kentucky.
I think that was you, Brent.
Yeah, just
did you sing that?
I put on the auto tune, right, and kind of disguised the voice a little.
Yeah, it was a different voice, right?
Yeah, but how about that? A campaign song centralized around Kentucky.
Yeah, they made it. They touched the people of Kentucky. Songs were big back then. Songs mattered for their campaigns. People would have songs.
Oh yeah, there's a whole long laundry list of these.
Right.
Some of them were really great, but they weren't necessarily Kentucky related. Things like Get on a Raft with Taft.
That was a song, though?
That's a real
song. That's a slogan.
Get on a Raft with Taft.
Well, I mean, that was entertainment. So it's kind of like a commercial. You get somebody to go around strumming, singing that song.
Yeah.
I know you want to. Old Kentucky. No. Why they call him Old Hickory, by the way?
He was tough.
Oh, okay.
So you're old Hickory.
Okay.
And then that makes James K. Polk young Hickory because he was his protege. That's kind of fun, too.
Yeah, Little Hickory.
Yeah, and it shows you the importance of Kentucky back then. In that time frame, Kentucky had a lot of electoral votes, relatively speaking.
Right.
So you might want to get that as an important swing state.
Yeah, we kind of get ignored now.
Yeah, it's part of the new modern Kentucky.
Just a few states.
But back then, it was really important. And, Jason, you'll be glad to know that the takeaway is dead.
Oh.
I will not be calling upon you for the takeaway anymore. You've never liked it in the first
Thank
place.
Thank you.
So
teacher?
We're out. We're out. That's it. The takeaway is dead, but we needed to acknowledge it.
No audio to go along with its death?
Trombone.
I'll be quiet.
That's true.
Thank
we
you.
We have now turned to the final page of this chapter. Old Kentucky Tales never fails to return, however. You can download even more episodes on iTunes or the NPR One app. Binge listen, as we like to say around here. If you like what you hear, please leave a review or rate us or contact us if you know a great story that we could talk about or someone we need to talk to. If you didn't like what you heard, there's no way you're here, so that's a moot point. Special thanks to WKMS, our producer Todd Birdsong, our guest Derek Lindo, the Paducah School of Art and Design, West Kentucky Community and Technical College, the home of making all this happen, and the rest is history.